So it's helpful to have a good foundation. And these four areas of the talks are the four good foundations upon which to live our lives and understand our lives, rest our lives. And the third foundation is the foundation of citta. And the word citta is usually translated in English as mind. But it's, as in a number of Asian Buddhist languages, the word could just as well be translated as heart. And so as you, I'll probably say mind, but if you would prefer heart, feel free to translate it as I speak. And the mind is, you know, the heart, the mind, is not the brain. Is something more intimate and something more personal than the brain. And some people, you know, I mean, part of the reason why citta is considered the heart is, if you ask someone in Burma where their citta is, they point to their chest. Whereas my guess is most, if you ask most people who are cultivated in the West where their mind is, they point to their head. When I was no one asked me this, but I think if someone had asked me when I was a new practitioner, before I came to Buddhism, where my awareness resides, where I'm aware, I would in fact would have pointed to my head. After I practiced for a number of years, someone asked me where awareness is, I would have said it's throughout my body. It wouldn't, not limited to my head or my brain. It's awareness, something which is broader than that, more global. And then at some point, continuing to practice, I think depends. I'll answer differently on different days, but more now, if someone said, "Where is your awareness?" I wouldn't point to anything here, my body or mind. I would just kind of like point to everywhere. You know, like, it's like, here it is. It doesn't have a location. And what it points to, this idea, is that what we call mind or awareness, the, at least the part of the mind we can kind of know, or the awareness which is part of it, is a quite a malleable concept. And it's like water. You know, water can take all kinds of the shape of whatever you pour it into. And our awareness is less, is more fluid than water. It's, you know, it's not a thing. You know, when's the last time someone held up their awareness for you to look at? You know, or packaged it nicely and talked about it. You know, it's just, you know, where, you know, it's, where's awareness? And so because it has no form in itself, no shape of its own, no color of its own, it can, you know, it's quite malleable and shiftable. And often what shifts it is our attitude, our understanding, or how it's used. So there are times when we take our awareness and we focus it very precisely. You can thread a needle and your awareness gets very precise just to that hole. Other times awareness gets quite broad, panoramic. You stand on the beach and watch a sunset or look at the mountains and look at the vista far away. And your mind kind of becomes much broader. Awareness is quite broad and expansive. And you don't try to just stare intently on, you know, in a particular peak far away unless someone's waving at you or you think they are, you know, trying to make sense of it. But you keep your awareness quite broad and open. Sometimes, we bring our attention really close. So, some people find this very satisfying to have very intimate attention. The awareness kind of really feels and senses and is present for something very, you have a sense of being close. Other times, it's more satisfying to have the awareness be step back and kind of watch from a distance. And you have not be in the middle of the fray, but actually step back and watch. And other times, standing back and watching too much, being the watcher, is being aloof and detached in a way that's not healthy. Sometimes being too close in and watching too tightly is an expression maybe of fear, that, you know, we're trying to just kind of too kind of locked in to what's going on. The So, you know, because awareness has no inherent shape or way of being, we can adjust it in all kinds of ways. And sometimes it's adjusted for us, and sometimes we practice and we can, you know, adjust it ourselves or find it, understand it. And, you know, so if someone gets you good and angry, then perhaps your awareness would get contracted, get narrow and, very focused and, you know, at that, and you wouldn't notice a lot of other things except the object of your anger. And so you've been shaped by the situation. Your awareness has been shaped by the situation. Or perhaps, you know, there's something wonderful happens to you and you feel relaxed and open, and that relaxed and openness leads to kind of more panoramic and open awareness that happens. Or perhaps some teacher tells you to, you know, really, you know, like some teachers will say, take like a magnifying glass to your experience and really go in there and penetrate. And then some people have kind of a laser-like focus and everything gets very small. And so other teachers say, have sky-like mind and have a mind like the sky, and so the mind gets really expansive. And then with some of these different kinds of minds, the mind states that people can have, there's also philosophies that support one over the other. That one is like ultimate or better or the right one or something. And I don't know if that's helpful to choose one or to make a big philosophy about which is the real one or something. The important thing is that, is to watch and see the quality, the characteristics of the awareness, the mind that we have ourselves. And the reason why this is, a number of reasons why this is important. One is that the quality of your awareness has a big impact on how you interpret and relate to the world. Also, the quality of your awareness of your mind or your heart is much closer to an essence of who you are than your identity or your thoughts or your feelings or, you know, your ethnicity or your gender. Or there's a lot of things that we take as being important. They are important. I don't want to belittle them. But you get down into the heart of the matter. I think it's much more satisfying and meaningful to take care of that and be with that in some profound way. So to begin touching into this foundation of our own heart, our own mind, and being able to see what it is an important part of the practice. And it has a lot to do, the quality of the mind, the characteristic of the mind, has a lot to do with our attitude or our disposition, our relationship to what's going on. So sometimes I like to say that there's always two things happening in the moment, in the present. There's what's happening and there's our relationship to it. And sometimes in practice we focus on what's happening, but sometimes it's very important to actually focus on, not so much on what's happening, but to focus on your relationship to what's happening. And in fact, the essence of the practice, the Buddhist practice, is about understanding in some significant way the nature of your relationship, how you relate to your experience. It isn't so much to understand the nature of reality. Buddhism, early Buddhism, is not a form of quantum physics that is describing the nature of reality. This is the true nature of reality. But rather, it's trying to point us to understand how the nature of our relatedness, how we relate, what is our attitude, how do we approach things. And it can be as simple as, you know, we relate to some things because we don't want it and we push it away, or we want it and we hold on to it. That's a relationship we have. And the nature and suffering, in the way that the early tradition defines it, it belongs to this world of how we relate. And if you want to become free of suffering, you have to understand something about how you relate to experience, what's going on. In some ways, this makes it easier and make practice easier. It also makes it more difficult. Because it's easier because it's always close at hand, the way you're relating. It's right here. And you don't have to fix the world. The world can do what it does, but it's the issue of practice is here and how you relate to it. On the other hand, it's more challenging because You have to take more responsibility for yourself then. And sometimes it's hard to turn around the attention and really see well enough what are we doing that is causing the suffering? What is the relationship we have? What's the attitude we have that's going on? And it can be very hard to see, and sometimes it can be even painful to even hear those words, that somehow it's the way you relate to the situation that is contributing to the suffering. But to begin paying attention to the relationship to what's your relationship to what's happening. So it isn't that the focusing on the breath is so important in and of itself, like the breath is going to be the key and save you, but rather the breath begins giving you understanding of your relationship to the breath. And how do you relate to it? Are you relating to it in a good way? I've had all kinds of relationships with my breath. It's kind of like, when you do enough meditation on the breath, it's kind of like marriage, you know. Suppose, you know, you have your good days and your bad days, and, you know, wonder, sometimes, you know, this is the great partnership, and then how did I end up with this one? And then, you know, so this breath, you know. And so it's relationship to the breath. And so I've been aversive to it, I've been angry at it, I've had all kinds of expectations about what it's supposed to be like, I've tried to manipulate it and fix it, I've tried to have better breaths, I've tried to get it to stop breathing because it's such a drag. You know, you name it, you know, I've done a whole bunch of things. And slowly, you know, I started to see that how much I invested in my meditation, my breath, and it was a very complicated relationship. And part of the course of practice is to simplify the relationship, simplify, to as simple level as you can. And one of the simple ways of being mindful, relating to mindful to breathing as you're mindful of it, is only to be mindful of it. That's it. There's no for and against, there's no judgment, no expectation, no evaluation, no past, no future, just this breath. So simple. And it's such a, it can be a great relief to experience that simplicity of just breathing. Or, you know, a relationship to meditation. There's your meditation experience, and then there's your relationship to it. There's the food. There's your relationship to it. There's the retreat center, and there's your relationship to it. There's the weather, and there's your relationship to it. There's your relationships to other people, and there's your relationship to those people, or your relationship to relationships, which is big for some people. Some people have like manifestos about what they believe about the relationships and what, how they have to be and how important they are or something. So we begin looking at what is the attitude, what's the beliefs, what are the relationships, how are we in relationship to it? And how we relate to it is big enough, it colors our mind. It colors our shapes, our awareness. So, anger sometimes, you know, I think it's expression in English, when you're angry, I see red, because it's so, you know, so strongly connected to red, the thing of being angry. So we have the mind is, the awareness is kind of reddish, maybe, when we're angry. The word I'm going to tell you in a little while from the sutta for passion, not the kind of passion that's popular in the modern world, but the passion that would used to be known as lust, that kind of passion. The Pali word is raga, and raga so it means lust or this kind of painful passion, but it also means in Pali it means a dye. When you dye clothes, it's because it colors. So somehow when we're filled with lust, it colors our perception. So we say in English, you know, a person has rose-colored glasses sometimes when they fall in love. And then later they say, what was I thinking? But, you know, that we kind of see it a certain way. And same thing can happen with aversion or anger. That can distort our perception of people and events because we see it through that lens. Of that way. So the foundation of mindfulness of citta, of mind, is to begin noticing the quality or the characteristic of the mind or awareness. How is it? And there's a list of things that the list is possibilities. And I think the list is meant to be things that are useful to pay attention to notice. So it's useful to notice when the mind, when you have a mind that's characterized by lust or craving or this kind of passion, this raga. Because if you know you have it, it's a lot better to know you have it than to have it and not know it. Because you're much more likely to do something that you later regret if you're under the influence of lust and you don't know it and you think it's just, this is just normal. So to know it, you have much more ability to choose wisely, to see what it is, to relate to it in a wise way, to know the time and place for it, for something. So it said it's useful to know when the mind is being characterized or colored. And it's a little bit different, or quite different, than simply having strong desire or having lust as a factor that arises in the mind. This means it's kind of like the mood of the mind. It's kind of like, it's not just a thought or a feeling that arises in a simple way, but it's strong enough that it shapes the awareness, shapes the mind. So, you know, you can see someone walking down the street, and sometimes you can see a mood clearly on display in the person. You see, that person's walking down the street has, you know, is a dark, is walking under a dark cloud. And you can kind of feel kind of the person's angry or miserable, or you see someone else and it's clear that they're, it's not just that they're momentarily happy, you just feel their happiness as they, you know, just bubbling out of them. It kind of characterizes who they are at that time. So to know when the mind state is characterized by lust is considered important. But it's also, the discourse says, to also know when the mind state is not characterized by lust. Now, that could keep you busy because there's probably lots of times when you're not lustful. And so you're supposed to go around kind of checking off every time you're not lustful. You'd be pretty busy for a long time. I don't think that's what's in mind, what the Buddha had in mind, but to know when the mind is characterized by lust and to know when it's not means that if you spend some time in the grips of desire, and then you're no longer in its grips, recognize that. Know what that's like. Because knowing the absence of something sometimes can help you understand the presence of something. Knowing the absence of something gives you a reference point that can be very supportive. So, you know, some people can struggle with mental states and be hypervigilant about them or focused on their importance, but it's not so important to have them gone. That's not like really relevant because those states are so important. But if, when it's absent, it teaches you something about the quality of the mind that's not caught in the grip of desire. And to hang out with that and get to know it, get a visceral feel of what that's like. And if you feel it as an alternative place, so it helps you to have that as a reference point, helps you to see when desire starts creeping in, you're much more likely to catch it. And also, you might know a place that's more satisfying desire. You might know that the place of no craving is more satisfying, so you're less inclined to kind of invest so much in desire or in lust, because you know there's an alternative that maybe even feels better. So the Buddha says, know when the mind is characterized by lust, know when it's not characterized by lust. So partly I think it's valuable, just as I said, to see the absence of something. But in the Pali language, the absence of something, it sometimes implies the presence of the opposite quality. So the opposite of craving or lust is generosity. So notice when the mind is characterized by generosity. It's possible. And then the Buddha goes on and says, know when the mind is characterized by aversion or ill will. Ill will is probably a better word. And know when it's when it is not characterized by ill will. The instructions are simply to know it as it is. It doesn't say, know it, and then criticize yourself. And know it and just decide that you're, you know, whatever you want to decide. Know it and then come up with a philosophy about why you should have ill will. It just says, know it. And I love this idea, this simplicity of just knowing. Some teachers make it their primary practice, emphasizing just know, just know, just know. And to get down, to pare it down to the simplicity of just knowing without any more complication and judgment and expectations and past and future is quite a profound thing. So here it basically says it, just know it. I think of it as a kind of a compassionate awareness, to know. So to know if there's ill will, just know it. Keep it simple. And to know when there's no ill will. So if you've been involved in ill will, anger, aversion for a while, and then it's not there, take some time to let that register deeply. This is what it's like when it's not there. Wow, I didn't know this is how it is. And then the opposite of ill will is loving kindness or compassion. So know if there is loving kindness or is compassion, recognize that. Know that well. Let that register. See it. And then know the mind that's with delusion, that's deluded, and know the mind that's without delusion. And some people are a little bit confused by this, because how can you know, if you're deluded, how can you know that you're deluded? If you knew you were deluded, you wouldn't be deluded. Maybe. But it's possible to actually watch the arising of delusion and not believe it. One of the interesting tremendous values of mindfulness practice is to have the ability to watch the arising of a thought and to see it as just a thought that arises, an interpretation that arises of a situation. As opposed to if mindfulness is not there, it's all too easy to have the interpretation, the story we make, the judgments we make, the ideas we have, to have them color how we see the situation, so much so that we think what we think is true. We think we have an accurate interpretation of the situation. Someone's walking down the street who maybe is really big, and the thought arises, this is a scary person. And so, because you see it as a thought that arises, the thought is in the mind, the person's over there. What's the connection between the thought and the person? Is your thought the same as the person? When life is fast and busy, we don't see the difference between how we interpret and the stories we make and what we're looking at, because it all happens in a jumble fast. But when you're slow enough in mindfulness, you can watch the arising of the thought, and you can see. and then you can see it as a thought, and the person's there, the thought is here. Then it gives you the opportunity to ask, is this true? Is this true? And perhaps that's when you give the person a second look. Let me look more carefully. Is this person really that dangerous? And maybe when you look more carefully, you find there's nothing dangerous about the person at all. It's just that big people scare you. And you know, nothing with the person. Maybe the person is obviously, you know, not a scary person if you look carefully. Or maybe they are scary. And then you duck for cover. Or do whatever you need to do. I find it quite a phenomenal thing to watch in my mind thoughts arise and to see them as a thought and to see that sometimes the thoughts I have aren't really very sound, aren't really based on what's actually going on in the world. And so then, because I can see it arising, I can question it and I can see, I don't necessarily tell myself I'm deluded, but so that's not right. That was an interpretation. And then I can take more responsibility, more careful about what's going on. It's one of the things I'm very grateful for this practice, to pay such careful attention. Sometimes it's the absence of delusion which can stand out and highlight. It's only afterwards we realize, what was I thinking? You know, I guess I had it all wrong. And rather than feeling bad, there's something valuable about registering that now that you see more clearly what it's like to see clearly, the positive side of it. Let it register. Take it in. This is what I feel. Now that I see how deluded I was, how wrong I was, how misinterpreted I was, there's a certain kind of clarity or a certain kind of freedom that comes with that. And it's maybe separate from your disappointment in yourself or the mistakes you made or something. But to emphasize the positive here and appreciate it so it becomes becomes a reference point or becomes something that's easy to go to again or something you value. So then it goes on and says, know a contracted mind as a contracted mind, and know a scattered mind as a scattered mind. And this is, I think, really interesting. One of the exercises I like giving, especially when I do my intro class, is to suggest to people to get themselves find a situation where they're calmer, a little bit calmer than usual, maybe through meditation or something else. And when they're calm, look at the quality of their mind. What does their awareness feel like? What is it like? How does it seem to them? And even though you maybe might not have words to articulate what it is, just let it register. Feel what the quality of mind is when you're relaxed. And just somehow let it kind of get a visceral sense of it. And then just go about your day and just wait until you have a really good situation where you get really caught up in something you're thinking about. Something really juicy or important happens and you just lock in it. And then, when you find a good opportunity like that, look then and see what is the quality of your mind then. And a lot of people will say things like, oh, when I was relaxed, my mind was more expansive. And when I got locked in on this preoccupation, I got very contracted. The mind became contracted and tight. Some people will talk about how it gets dark. When it's relaxed, there's a kind of certain kind of transparency or luminosity that some people will, not that there's any light in the mind, but it kind of feels, somehow it's people associated with that kind of light, clarity. But, get caught up in some really juicy thought, and this kind of darkness sets in, kind of like everything closes in. And you can see, again, this malleable quality of awareness in the mind, how it shifts and changes. So the instructions are, when the mind is contracted, know it as a contracted mind. Just know it. See it. And then when the mind is scattered, know it as scattered. It's agitated, jumping around, running around, busy. Just know it. And one of the great discoveries I had in practicing on retreat was the tremendous value of using the mental note chaos. I've been trying to, I try to look at my breath, I try to look at particular things to be mindful of. I was taught to always be mindful of objects, something particular. So I was looking for something. And there's sometimes it just got really frustrating. And it was just like so much going on, it was so confusing, and it just, there was no particular thing. And finally I just, what's happening? I'm confused. Or there's just chaos. And it's like this, that was the biggest label I can come up with. That was all encompassing of the whole big bang situation. And then, I can be present for chaos. So there's chaos. I can be present for confusion. I can't be so present for the details of what I'm trying to figure out. That's too much, but I'll just step back and be aware of this big thing. So a scattered mind can be hard if you try to think you're supposed to be unscattered, but can you back up? Can you be back up? Can you make the mind big? How big do you have to be able to hold a scattered mind, an agitated mind? I've had some wonderful sittings where I was restless, really restless. And I imagined my restlessness with a ping pong ball. And I closed my, I had my eyes closed, and I just kind of like, I was like watching the ping pong ball bouncing around inside my body, but like almost like bouncing off the inside walls of my skin, you know. It was kind of, got me fun that way, you know, playful and, you know, that was interesting. And then slowly, it's kind of settled down. So when the mind gets contracted, oftentimes it's because of how we're relating to something. And so we can always come back and ask ourselves, how am I relating to this? Am I afraid? Am I desirous? Am I interpreting it? Am I identifying with it strongly? Why am I investing so much importance in this thing? What's that relationship? What's that interpretation? The other thing that's possible to do is to open up the awareness for any of these mind states that are difficult. Fear can be difficult, for example, or anger can be difficult, and a scattered, agitated mind can be difficult. Some people find it helpful to expand their mind, their awareness, to become bigger and bigger. And because, you know, awareness is not a thing, it's a little bit so malleable. Some people can just imagine their mind is as big as this room. And if that's not big enough to hold the anger or the fear, just imagine the mind gets even bigger. Maybe as big as, you know, this whole valley here, canyon. Or if that's not big enough, as big as the state of California. If that's not big enough, just keep going out until you have it big enough. Imagine you're like on the moon looking down at the earth. Maybe then it's okay to look at your fear. Just make lots of space. Keep lots of breathing room for what you're feeling. And so some people find that they open. At some point, it's okay to be with their fear. And so they can hold it and just be with it. So they end up expanding out. So if the mind is really agitated and scattered, sometimes it's possible to open up. How big do you have to get? So you can somehow become bigger than the agitation. And then if you're bigger than the agitation, just let the agitation be there. If the ping pong thing work is interesting for you, imagine, you know, ping pong balls bouncing around inside, if that's, or maybe you have another image for it. So the contracted mind is the contracted mind, the scattered mind is the scattered mind. The next he said, expanded mind as the expanded mind, and the unexpanded mind is the unexpanded mind. This is like the big mind. Sometimes the mind does feel really big and broad. And when the mind feels broad and wide and spacious, to know that, to know it. And when it doesn't feel that way and feels small, to know that. Just to know how it is. Know how it is. There's something, when we know, something very profound things happen when we just rely on just the simple knowing of what's happening. If we can really do it, it frees us from all the more complicated ways in which we relate to something. So that's one thing that can happen. The other thing is that the simple knowing of something, I believe, is a kind of love. We love something. There's something very meaningful about really seeing something. And one of the forms of suffering that I've seen that is very deep in some people, among some of the deepest that people have, is when as children they weren't seen. No one saw them. Because somehow there's a seeing and love are so closely connected. And so this knowing or the seeing of this is how it is, I think is a profound healing kind of love that we can offer ourselves just to know it in an open-handed, kind of generous way. Here, this is what's happening. And then the final one in this list is to know a liberated mind as a liberated mind, a free mind as a free mind, And an unliberated mind is an unliberated mind. So this is to actually know, not that you're contracted, but to know that you're, if you're unliberated, to actually get a feeling of what it's like to be clinging, to be holding on, to be grasping. And to really know that. And really know that. Really, kind of take your time to get to know it. It helps if you don't see grasping or clinging as a failing. These poor Buddhists, you know, they hear about the Four Noble Truths and source of suffering is your clinging, and here I am clinging and I'm a bad Buddhist and I shouldn't be doing it. That's kind of an unfortunate attitude. When you cling, know you cling, which means really get to know it. Look at it. Let it be there. Simplify your relationship to it. Don't be so complicated with it. There's something profound that happens when you get to know it, see it. The kind of knowing where you are not enmeshed in it. In the knowing itself, we can begin finding how to be independent, not clinging to anything. So where's this independence? Even our independence from our clinging. So to know the unliberated mind, to know when we're stuck and caught, and then learn how, slowly, it's not easy, learn how to have a simple relationship to that, an uncomplicated relationship to it. Not to identify with it and say, you know, make it personal, just clinging. And then to know a liberated mind, to know a mind that's free of clinging. There are moments sometimes in people's lives where they feel, now I'm free of it. I'm free of something. I was struggling with something, I was caught in something for a long time, and now I'm not. I'm free. And maybe it's only for a few moments. But when that happens, it's very helpful to know it, to be respectful of that state and feeling. Let it register. Drink it in. Feel it fully. Because what, in feeling the good things fully, acknowledging it, it reinforces our tendency to want to go there. It encourages the mind that this is a good, this is a safe place, this is helpful. And so then you're more likely to want to go there rather than go to the other places maybe where the mind goes. So to really know that you're free, and then also to know what you're free from. The Buddhist tradition puts a lot of emphasis on freedom, but it's not an abstract freedom, so you can, you know, so you're free to shop till you drop or something. It's a freedom from particular states that are afflictive, that cause suffering. So when you're free, to know what you're free of, to know that now I'm free of craving, I'm free of clinging, I'm free of hate and ill will, I'm free of anxiety, I'm free of shame, I'm free of regret, free of fear, I'm free of taking things so personally. So to kind of see what it is that you, and you know, it's probably better not to see it all or nothing. See that just moments, or see that you're free, becoming freer and freer. But part of the emphasis in Buddhism and freedom is to know what you're free of. That's part of the maturation, maturing process. It's not just some kind of vague, amorphous experience of enlightenment, the great it. Either you know it or you don't. If you don't know it, you don't want to admit it. And so no one admits it, but there's an it, this great it, the thing, the enlightenment. But we're not going to talk about it because we don't know what it is. Or something. But at least in the early Buddhist tradition, liberation, experience of liberation is always followed with a review and to really know, what am I free from? And freedom is not measured by some luminous, open, clear mind or some great blissful experience. It's measured by what you're free from. That's what's important. And so I'll end with an analogy that I like. Two people go to jail together at the same time, spend years in jail together, and then they're released the same day. The gates of prison open up, and they both have the same experience of the gates opening up, and they step into a free world. So they're both liberated. But what they do with their liberation is very different. They part their ways, and their lives take very different courses. They share the quality of liberation, liberated from prison, but they don't share necessarily the same kind of life after that. So the same thing with Buddhist liberation. We all share, with being liberated, we share the freedom from things that keep us bound and caught. But what happens to us and what we do with that afterwards varies from person to person. And it doesn't have to look any particular way. It doesn't have to look like you're a good Buddhist even. It doesn't have to look like, you know, like you're always blissed out, or, you know, or that you're always somehow spacious and whatever. It doesn't have to look like anything. Because if you're free, you're free to respond and be part of the world in the way that the situation requires, in the way who you are and everything. But what characterizes you is that you're no longer caught in the grips of greed, of hate, delusion. That's always there. But you're always going to be joyful, always going to be peaceful, always going to be wise. Who knows? I think there's a great reluctance in the early tradition to specify in a positive way what you'll be like if you're free, except by saying you'll be free from these things. And I think it's very generous that you're allowed to be who you are. Just be. So in my early years of practice, I was practicing Zen, and one of the important lessons that I learned through Zen teachings I heard, is the tremendous value, importance in being yourself. That practice, in a sense, was not to make you a super person, but to allow you just to be yourself. And so when in that spirit, it was a magic moment, very special moment for me, when my Zen teacher, in a casual conversation, turned to me and said, I was telling him about what I was doing, and he was asking questions. I told him about my job and different things I was doing. And in the most easy, kind of casual way, he turned to me and said to me, "Just to be alive is enough. Just to be alive is enough." And that little statement had its big impact on me. Because up until then, just being alive was not enough. I needed to succeed, I needed to prove myself, I needed to defend myself, I needed to, you know, I had a long list of things. But just to be yourself, be simple. So the hope, my hope is that you engage in this beautiful and profound process of freeing yourself from attachments, from clinging, from greed, hate, and delusion, from fear. It's a process. And that in that, walking that path and following that process, you become more and more yourself as you are. So each of us can be ourselves, because each of us is very important, worthy, worthwhile, valuable. And I hope this practice leads to a kind of certain dignity and valuing of everybody, and in that we create a society of people who relate to each other in wise ways. So your relationship to what's happening is important. Sometimes your relationship to what's happening is strong enough that it shapes and colors the quality of your mind, the state of your mind. And so it's useful, one of the foundations of the practice is to notice what's the general quality of the mind, what's the state the mind is in now. and to just know it in a simple way, and to know it in the course of a day how it shifts and changes. Now, sometimes it's one color and one shape and characterized one way, and other times other ways. And as you become wiser and wiser and more recognize the quality of the mind, you'll probably find that you become more understanding about how you can relate wisely to the situation. You're less likely to be caught in the situation that you're in. You can step back and be freer from what's happening because you know it, because you see what's happening. So let's take a couple of minutes and gather ourselves.